Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to another edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. Joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith, but also joining me this week is Representative Attica Scott, who is a member of the Kentucky House of Representatives, where she serves the District of 41. How are you today, Ms. Scott?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
Doing very well. We're excited to have you on the show. Jasmine, why don't you tell us about Ms. Scott?
All right. Attica Scott is a member of the Kentucky House of Representatives, where she serves the people of District 41, which stretches from the Chickasaw neighborhood in the West End all the way to St. Matthews in Louisville. Previously, Ms. Scott served on the Louisville Metro Council for District 1 from 2011 to 2014, and District 1 stretches from Chickasaw to Cane Run. Professionally, Ms. Scott is an educator and a community organizer. And as a member of Metro Council, she successfully led the push to ban the box, which required former felons to indicate their criminal history on job applications. Ms. Scott is the only woman of color in the Kentucky legislature, one of only seven total people of color, and one of only 26 women. Ms. Scott has said before that her proudest accomplishment is being a mom to her two children. And so this is our very first guest on My Old Kentucky Podcast, and I think we have a really great one. So we're going to be asking her some questions and just chatting with her today. So, Representative Scott, the first question I had, I wanted to talk a little bit about Emerge Kentucky. You were one of the first graduates of Emerge Kentucky back in 2010. Emerge Kentucky being a program that encourages and trains women to run for office. At what point did you decide that you wanted to try public service?
Well, and I will say about Emerge Kentucky that it trains Democratic women to run for office,
right,
which is a big key for people to know and to understand about the program. And I decided to run for office 7 years ago. I ran for school board and did not win, but I ran because I had two kids who were in the public school system, a system that I'm a product of, and I cared about their education and their experience as well as other kids who were in the school system. And but before that, I actually worked on the campaign of a friend of mine who successfully ran for city council in Knoxville, Tennessee. We went to college together. And then I worked for a woman who was a county commissioner at the time, who is now the first woman mayor of the city of Knoxville. So I had a little bit of political experience.
You had some experience yourself before you actually ran for office then. So in 2014, you actually lost an election. How are you able to learn from that experience and bounce back to then win a different election this past year in 2016?
Well, I learned from all of my losses. So when I lost the school board race, I learned to continue to stay involved, stay engaged. And so when I ran for Metro Council, people knew me as someone who had been involved and engaged. And then when I lost the re-election for Metro Council, continued to stay involved and engaged. And so when I ran in 2016 for state representative, folks were supportive. They were ready to have my energy and my perspective and experience in Frankfort.
Right. And you actually beat a longtime incumbent in that race, didn't you?
I did. And someone who, in fact, his wife had served in the legislature before him. So it was a longtime family serving in office, and people were ready for something new and different.
Right. And I think we're all pretty excited about that. Could you talk a little bit about serving in Metro Council is different from being in the state legislature?
It's a huge difference. So on Metro Council, although we did have party affiliations, it wasn't as divisive as it is in Frankfort. I mean, there were many times where I voted with my Republican colleagues on issues around accountability and transparency, and times where we were able to pass unanimous bipartisan legislation like Ban the Box and a resolution to Frankfort to restore voting rights for people who were once incarcerated. Now, serving in Frankfort, it seems like there's so much unnecessary polarization and divisive politics just for the sake of being divisive. And it's also a much larger body of people. So the council was 26 people in Frankfort. We have 138, 100 in the House, 38 in the Senate. So it's very different. And then, of course, Metro Council, all of us were from Jefferson County.
Right.
In Frankfort, we're from 120 counties.
And that's kind of my next question. Most of Kentucky is rural, while Louisville is obviously very urban in comparison to the rest of the state. How do you think that impacts the priorities of the legislature?
Well, of course, the priorities are going to tend to lean to rural areas. And I lived in East Tennessee for 14 years, so I have a lot of understanding about what it means to live in rural areas, Appalachian communities. And so I have a lot of affinity for folks in Eastern Kentucky and Western Kentucky. And so I can understand to a certain extent why there's so much focus and emphasis on rural areas, as there should be. I mean, folks are working every day to save Appalachia, and so we should support those efforts. At the same time, there's a lot of work that needs to happen in places like Lexington and Louisville, and so we can't overlook that.
Right. You mentioned that when you were on the Metro Council, there were Republicans on Metro Council, but, you know, we're here in Louisville, a pretty Democratic county, and I can't really imagine Democrats ever losing control of Metro Council while the Kentucky legislature is now completely controlled by Republicans. How does that impact your role?
It means that I have to work on the relationships that I had with two of my colleagues who we actually served together on Metro Council. They're Republican. It also means that it's important for me to build relationships with people who live in other parts of the state and people who are Republican, so that one, they can understand some of the challenges that my district faces, and two, I can understand some of the challenges that their district faces. And it also means that I have to be authentic, that if there's an issue that's been supported by mostly Republicans that I believe in and stand with and can support, then I should do that. And the same for them. If there's an issue that I'm advocating or wanting to advance and they can support it, they should support it. It shouldn't be about partisan politics.
So the legislative session this so far, we've talked about it on our show, and you were there, so you know plenty about it. But one of the things that really marked this session was the speed at which Republicans were really able to push through a lot of the things they supported. And I was just wondering, from your perspective, do you feel like as Democrats you could have done more, or do you feel like just the fact that there were so many Republicans that were ready to go that there was just not much that was able to be done?
Well, I think a couple of things happened. The first day we were expected to vote on a piece of legislation that was connected to our internal operations without anyone seeing the rules.
Right.
So, I mean, that's how we got the USA Patriot Act. People didn't have time to read the 800-page document. Now you have us voting on the rules of how we would govern ourselves in the House. Ridiculous. And then every single day after that, there was something else that was happening with the kind of speed and quickness that really didn't allow people to dig deep into the issue. And it was unnecessarily speedy. Issues that were considered an emergency were really not emergencies.
Right.
It was really about the governor and his agenda and what is now really his legislature. And so as Democrats, I believe that we stood up and fought back to the best of our ability. I mean, every single opportunity we had to speak on issues, we did. And we have long-term members who understood the rules and used those to our advantage. And our pushing back did each day find some things changing little by little by little. So whether it was limiting debate initially to on Saturday when we shouldn't have been there in the first place, allowing debate to be extended.
Right. I mean, you mentioned the rules, and that was something that I watched happen. And I was very interested to see it happen, because it seemed like the Democrats and Republicans were operating under a completely different set of assumptions. The Democrats kind of thought this is going to be like it always is. You know, we're going to spend the first week, we're going to elect people, we're going to set up the phones, we're going to take a little bit of time to get everybody acclimated, and then we'll kind of get down to business. And the Republicans were like, no, we're going to go ahead and start moving right now. So I think that as time has gone along, the Democrats maybe have learned a lot. And so do you think that you can take those lessons, and when you go back into session next month, the Democrats will be able to do some different things to maybe slow some stuff down, or maybe keep some of their priorities in order?
We may be able to do some things. The reality is that first week I didn't have an office.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, there are some basic things that were done by design. So there's only so much you can do when you don't have the inability to check email, the inability to get phone calls from your constituents, the inability to take meetings with your constituents unless you're just, you know, huddled up, you know, in a corner somewhere. So the first week was designed to try to throw us off balance and, you know, make sure that we weren't on top of things. And it didn't work. You know, we made sure that we took care of business, and we fought back for women and workers in this state, and in fact, the University of Louisville as well. For me, what that says is when I go back on February 7th, I need to have made sure that I spent these past few weeks getting prepared for some of the bills that I know are going to be on the agenda.
Sure.
It's not like it's going to be a surprise, much of what's going to be on the agenda.
Right.
So if I and my colleagues haven't taken this time to do our research and to ask the questions of people who know more about these issues than we did, then it's going to be our fault when we go back if we're not prepared.
I want to ask you a question about the way that the legislature is structured right now. Speaking to you, and in case anybody didn't know, you're a very progressive Democrat. I mean, nobody would deny that, and I don't think you would either. Mm-hmm. But with people who are more progressive than the median Democrat in the legislature, we've learned in a big way, based on the bills that have been passed already in this session, how important it has been for Democratic priorities to even hold one chamber. That gives you the ability to keep things from coming to the floor. It gives you the ability to kind of make sure your priorities get in front of the full legislature. And when that doesn't happen, what we saw during the first week of the session occurs. So talk to me a little bit about how you feel about progressive Democrats and the more conservative Democrats in your coalition. And how can progressive Democrats balance the need for ideological purity and the need to kind of call out people in your own caucus with the importance of building power and the importance of making sure that you have at least some sort of balance between the two chambers in the legislature?
Sure. And what I found with the Democratic Party, period, whether it's here in the state or nationally, is that there is no purity. I mean, I believe that Black Lives Matter. Not every Democrat is willing to say the same thing.
Sure.
So, you know, that notion of purity, I'm like, nah, that doesn't exist. I don't know that it ever has. What I will say is that those of us who are progressive have to remain progressive because we were elected for a reason. And part of the reason people from east to west in Louisville elected me to go to Frankfort is because they knew that I would stand up and fight for what they believe in. It also means that just because I'm progressive doesn't mean that I'm not going to fight for people who are struggling in western Kentucky where coal mines have shut down, or
sure.
people in northern Kentucky who want to see economic development. I'm still going to do that. At the same time, I'm going to make sure that folks in Louisville know that I'm going to stand up and fight for them as well.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about identity. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, I know that's a very important issue for everybody in the state and for you particularly. Mm-hmm. So 8% of Kentuckians are African American. And then that means that in a truly representative legislature, there would be at least 5 women of color. You're the only one.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about this representation. Now, you know, women of color is not a monolithic group by mm-hmm. any means. Do you feel like you have any pressure on you to be representative of this entire group of person? And do you worry much about tokenism and being used as kind of a football back and forth?
I don't worry about tokenism because I'm definitely not the Democratic Party's darling. So that's probably never going to happen with me. And that's just fine. But it does bother me that neither party has done the work that they should do to make sure that they have more women of color, not just Black women, but Native women, Latinas, Asians, other women of color. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party have both failed women of color. And what I will say is that it's also unfortunate that in the first week that I was in Frankfort as the only Black woman, that leadership in the House, Republican leadership, decided that they would sit the most racist, blatantly racist person in the House in front of me. While on the one hand, I see that as an attempt at trying to silence me, which of course didn't work. I don't even imagine anyone thought that that would happen, but you know, you always try. The other part of me feels like out of 100 seats, you mean you couldn't find one other seat to put this person in. And so I went to my leadership and they went to Republican leadership, and that should be changed when we go back on February 7th. And I'll let folks know if it isn't changed, and we're going to have a problem in Frankfort if my seat and his seat are in the same place.
Absolutely. Well, okay. So Kentucky, you know, while it is a very white state, there have been several important women of color in its history. So Amelia Tucker, who was the first woman of color to hold a position in the Kentucky legislature, Georgia Davis Powers, who's legendary, and then Eleanor Jordan, who ran for Congress in the 3rd District, I think in 2000, maybe just 2000, mm-hmm. or 98, one of those two. Talk about how these women's examples have impacted your journey, and do you take from them, or do you want to separate yourself and create your own legacy, or something in between?
I soak it up, what they left behind for women like me and women who look for some kind of inspiration, because they were inspiration. I mean, the same year that Senator Georgia Davis Powers passed away is the same year that I was elected to go to Frankfort. For me, as a woman of faith, there's something really spiritual about that. I had the opportunity to be introduced recently by Eleanor Jordan at an event celebrating the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. So you had the last woman to serve in the House introducing the next woman, the current woman who's serving in the House. And she's been a political mentor to me. For my daughter to be able to have met Senator Georgia Davis Powers and for my daughter to know the Honorable Eleanor Jordan is pretty significant and it's pretty huge. And I think it's important for all of us to continue to lift up those stories because they're the stories of Kentucky. I mean, mm-hmm. women of color and people of color have been part of Kentucky from the very beginning. And so We have to make sure we're doing the work to make sure that their legacies stay relevant to folks all across the state.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Jeanine Hampton, who's a lieutenant governor of Kentucky, and she's also a black woman. She ran with Matt Bevin, who I don't think you're friends with him. Not, or, you know,
no.
Not too close. You're not on each other's Christmas cards list.
Nope.
But she's the first black statewide office holder in the entire state of Kentucky in the whole history. I mean, Kentucky's been controlled by Democrats for a very long time. There's been, I think, three Republican governors in maybe the last half century or so. No black office holders in the executive branch until Jeanine Hampton. What do you think about her election? How should we think, or how do you think about her election as a black woman to an executive branch position of power?
There were a lot of black folks when she was running who were excited by the fact that she was chosen to be lieutenant governor to Matt Bevin. And at the time, I don't know that people really cared that it was Matt Bevin. It was the fact that Jeanine Hampton was chosen to be lieutenant governor. They didn't know her, didn't know anything about her, but she was a black woman, and that was huge. But unfortunately, people have heard her and seen her in action and have realized that just because you're black doesn't mean that you represent black folks and many of our interests. But what I will say is what I said earlier is that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party both are guilty of not doing enough to make sure that they lift up women of color in office, whether it's local or statewide office. And so both parties have work to do. My party has work to do. And I've called my party out on its work over the past decade since I've been back home. So hopefully we will learn some lessons from what we're seeing and step out there and encourage other women of color to run for office. But not only encourage, but to support, because that's huge. You got to support people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. So let's talk a little bit about social media. You've used social media to great effect. You have a very significant following on Twitter and other platforms. Is Twitter your favorite? I don't know.
Twitter is definitely my favorite. I do use Facebook, my Facebook page, yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, for all the talk of people call it internet slacktivism, you've been able to actually create change using social media. The one that sticks out to most of me was your tweets about Butler High School's dress code. Mm-hmm. And that started a campaign that ended with that school relaxing its policy on natural hair. So how important do you think social media is to what you do? Do you use it as an outlet or as a space for sharing ideas, a place to organize, all of the above or none of the above?
All of the above, and I do have to say that I've been on Facebook and Twitter for almost a decade, so I got on there long before I ever ran for office. So I was authentic then, and I remain authentic now. Sometimes when you follow people who are elected officials, you're like, wait, that doesn't even sound like their voice, because they probably have someone else who runs their social media. I am the person who does my social media. There's no one else who does it. I remain the person who I was nearly a decade ago when I got on social media. And what I used it for then is similar to what I use it for now. So when I was at Jobs with Justice, organizing people across the state of Kentucky, social media was a quick way to get to folks. We organized a social forum in Berea, Kentucky, with more than 400 people from across the entire Commonwealth using Facebook and Twitter. That's how we did it. There was really no other way for us to be able to organize folks from across the state. And we got them there. It was huge. And so now as an elected official, I'm still using social media to get folks to either go to a council meeting, school board, or to Frankfurt. I always encourage people when they're thinking about running for office to make sure that they use social media. I actually have an upcoming class that I'm doing with the next class of Emerge Kentucky, where I'm talking about how do you use social media as a candidate. For me, it's something that I embrace, that I welcome. I know that some people feel uncomfortable in that medium because it's not necessarily something they're familiar with, but I welcome it as a way to exchange thoughts and ideas.
Absolutely. Yeah, and for whatever you could say about the president, he's definitely used social media to great extent. And I think there's something to be said for using your own voice, which is also something that I think he certainly does.
Mm-hmm.
So about people, you talked about people running for office and encouraging people to do that. The impact of social media on new campaigns, if somebody doesn't know what they're doing, is it possible for it to cause more harm than good? Or do you think just people need to train, or can people forego it entirely? Is it just necessary in today's day and age, or can people get away with it not having it?
A lot of it depends on where you are, because we do still have a digital divide, whether it's based on race or it's based on geography. Mm-hmm. People don't necessarily have broadband access to be able to use social media the way that they would like to in some areas. So I acknowledge that. But if you are somewhere where you know people are on social media, use it. why wouldn't you use it? I mean, it's there. it doesn't cost anything, so why not take advantage of it and use it for what it's going to be for you, which is a tool for information sharing to make sure you're driving people to your fundraising page, or to make sure that you're driving people to your page for them to volunteer and to get involved, or to your issue page so that they know where you stand. And I will also say to people that if you're just now thinking about running for office, then this is your opportunity to create your voice on social media and to be something new for folks and to be a place where they go to find out what in the world's going on in their community.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Ms. Scott, for coming in and talking to us. If people want to connect with you, how can they do that?
They can connect with me in a number of different ways. I don't yet have my office in Frankfurt. So
you still don't have it?
Yeah, I imagine it's somewhere on the fourth floor, but they can definitely email me. So they can email me at attica@lrc.ky.gov. And that is the same naming sequence for just about all of the legislators. So if I'm not your legislator and you need to contact yours, it's usually firstname.lastname@lrc.ky.gov. They can follow me on social media. I have a Facebook page and I'm on Twitter, and I would be happy to hear from folks.
Excellent. Again, thank you so much for coming in, and good luck with the rest of the session.
Thank you so much.
Jasmine, this brings us to the end of another episode of My Old Kentucky Podcast. That was pretty fun, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Did you learn anything from Representative Scott?
Yeah, she's amazing.
She is really cool. You definitely follow her on Twitter. She's a great follow, and you'll definitely learn new things, and you'll be kept up with what's going on in the session.
I feel like we set the bar really high for guests on our show.
We did, but you know what? That's what we do. We shoot for the stars. All right, Jasmine. So if people want to get in touch with us, how can they do that?
They can find us on Twitter @myoldkypod, and they can like our Facebook page where we post updates to stories and things we talk about, as well as our episodes. They can also check out our show notes on Medium, and then you can find our podcast on pretty much any podcasting app of your choice, iTunes, Stitcher, whatever you have.
Yeah. All right. Well, excellent, Jasmine. And we will see you, and we will talk to everybody next week.